The Infrastructure Show is brought to you by Wyss Janney Elsner Associates, engineers, architects, and materials scientists, solving complex problems in contemporary and historic structures since 1956. Learn more at wje.com.
Welcome to The Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
The Port of Savannah, Georgia is located on the Savannah River, about 18 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, and is operated by the Georgia Ports Authority. While the Port of Savannah is the nation's fourth busiest container port, the Savannah River shipping channel is not deep enough to accommodate the supersized cargo ships that will soon operate through the enlarged Panama Canal.
The Savannah Harbor Expansion Project, or SHEP, based on 12 years of planning and research by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, will deepen the channel so that it can accommodate the larger ships. We have with us today to discuss this expansion project Curtis Fultz, who's executive director of the Georgia Ports Authority. Curtis, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Port of Savannah and its current role in international trade and what it does for Savannah and for Atlanta as well?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think first and foremost, as a port authority, we own and operate the ports throughout the state of Georgia. So it's not just our container facility that we're going to be talking about today in Savannah. But Georgia's ports operate two deepwater ports in Savannah and three deepwater ports in Brunswick, Georgia. The Port Authority came into existence back in the 1940s. And one of the things that's unique about ourselves is not only do we own the assets, like which is a typical structure as a Port Authority for states or local municipalities, but as a Georgia Ports Authority, we also operate our facilities. So we are quite unique in our design. As has already been mentioned, we've been the fastest growing port in the country for the last decade from a container perspective. We are currently the fourth busiest container terminal in the United States, and we service customers in almost all 48 contiguous states in the lower 48. But be that as it may, we've truly become a gateway for commerce in the Southeast, not just certainly in and around the Savannah area, but Atlanta, but for the entire Southeast.
And what was the impetus for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to begin work on the Savannah Harbor Expansion Project 12 years ago?
Well, you know, it goes back even before 1999, which is when Congress authorized the project. It started back in the mid-90s, back in 1996. There was a general acknowledgement by many in the trade, and the Savannah River being a federal channel, there was a what was called an initial reconnaissance work that was done back in 1996 that said this federal navigation channel needed to be expanded. And that led to, in 1999, Congress authorizing in the Werder Bill of 1999, instructed the Army Corps of Engineers to go study both the several things, but effectively study the value to the nation for deepening the Savannah River from its current depth, which is 42 feet at mean low water, up to a depth of 47 feet. So that was the original authorization in 1999. So the Corps began extremely detailed and exhaustive studies to identify the environmental impacts of deepening the river, what construction would be required to service vessels that were projected to be in use, identify the economic impacts of doing or deepening or alternatively not deepening, what the cost would be to commerce, and then ultimately at the end of the day, making a recommendation back to Congress based on, again, very detailed financial and economic modeling on what would be in the nation's best interest, what depth to deepen the harbor to. And their recommendation was that to deepen it to 47 feet from its current depth of 42 feet.
That's a lot of different stuff there that we're going to explore. But for starters, what did they find when they looked at the environmental impact?
Well, there are hosts, and the Tier 2 environmental statement or document is about 11 feet long in length. So I won't profess to, and I'm not the technical expert on it, but what they've said, there will be impacts on dissolved oxygen. There will be impacts on salinity. There'll be tidal impacts. And ultimately, what they've come back and identified is that all of the impacts can and will be mitigated as part of the recommendations in the project. But, you know, there are a host of issues that are out there, and I would tell you that the Army Corps of Engineers is very confident and has come up with an extremely detailed plan with all of the environmental agencies that were involved in this project to mitigate the impacts of deepening the Savannah River.
Are there any contaminated materials that have to be removed?
There is a naturally occurring material in the river, and it's called cadmium. And as part of the deepening, that cadmium will be removed. The Corps come up with a plan to place it in one of their dredge spoiled sites and to cap it with an earthen material. But to my knowledge, that's the only material that's been identified.
So is the spoil site nearby?
Yeah, the state of Georgia, through the Georgia Department of Transportation, GDOT, owns approximately 13,000 acres along the Savannah River. And it is used today and will be used for this project in a rotational dredge spoilage kind of program. So they've got several earthen areas that are diked. And in today's environment, there is about between $15 and $18 million a year that the Army Corps of Engineers spends annually for removal and maintaining the depth of the river at its current depth, the Federal Channel at its current depth.
The 42-foot depth.
At 42-foot depth in the Savannah River. And they use these sites and have a, I think it's almost a perpetual easement. It's at least a 50-year lease for the purposes of placing dredge spoilage on it. And it's a typical core and a typical core project. They'll rotate each of the sites. They'll place material in a site, and they'll let it effectively rest and settle and dry, and then they'll either use the material to raise the dikes again or remove the material, and then it'll be used a decade or so later, but they'll go down. And I think there are five or six sites within this acreage, but it's part of the Corps' plan, and that's where this material would be placed.
What kind of dredges are used in this process? I'm trying to understand how the material is not only removed, but how it's transported to the spoil site.
Well, these will be standard large dredges. The material will be piped from the dredge itself. So, again, what would happen in a project like this, you would have the dredge that is located on a barge, and it will be attached. There will be piping that is attached to the dredge, and the dredge, almost like a slurry when it's dredged up from the bottom of the river, is passed along this piping system and pumped into one of these sites, which typically will be several miles from where the dredge is physically located.
Is it necessary when you're working 42 feet underwater, there have to be divers under there operating any of this machinery?
No, they've got camera systems and highly sophisticated sensor systems to manage the dredge activity itself. And you and I am candidly amazed at the precision with which they can dredge the bottom of the river. But no, you won't have divers in the water.
And are there any particular technical challenges associated with this project, or is it mainly just a matter of the enormous scale of it?
You know, I think as dredging projects go, it's relatively standard. The channel itself, there are several components of what I would refer to as the construction phase of the project. You know, they have a slope design to the channel that has already been incorporated in the design. Not only will they deepen the main channel is going to be extended by about 11 miles, or by 7 miles, but the outermost 11 miles of the outer channel, we'll refer to as inner channel, is realigned for better navigational purposes. And then inside the channel itself, they're going to improve several passing areas where the largest generation ships can improve their ability in navigating the channel to pass each other. As part of the project, the Corps will also, what is referred to as kind of bend wideners, but they'll effectively straighten the channel out in certain areas. And then they will expand the turning basin where the vessels currently upriver in turn, whether on their way in or departing the port itself. So there are several components of the construction phase, but in terms of just dredging projects, it's a large project, but I think a fairly routine project.
From looking at the map and air photos, I get the impression that that turning basin was inland, was upstream from the main container port. Is that correct?
Well, it's at the upper end of it, and typically that's where a turning basin would be located because it needs to be either a vessel is going to turn on its way in or out, and it effectively needs to be able to reach all or most of the terminal before the ships are required to turn. So it's located on the very upper end of our container facility, and so it's well-positioned and well-suited for what it's been designed for.
And that's going to be not only deepened but enlarged, do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, the main channel will remain 500 feet, but the turning basin itself will be enlarged to a total of 1,600 feet in its entire circular shape, but it'll be 1,600 feet wide at all points. But the main channel, again, will remain 500 feet. The outer channel will be 600 feet. The inner channel will be 47 feet deep. The outer channel will be 49 feet deep. And I think a very unique thing about our port and our river geologically is that we are benefited by what is on average a 7-foot tide. So on top of the levels that are quoted, the 47 feet is at mean low water. So at high tide, we'll effectively have 54 feet and the outer channel will have 56 feet at high tide.
And did I understand you correctly to say that it's wide enough that ships can pass each other? Can two ships be passing side by side at the same time?
They routinely pass each other today. In fact, they do almost on a daily basis, typically multiple times a day. The largest ships calling the Eastern Seaboard today, just so happened the largest ship coming into our port was a 9,200 TEU class vessel. It was a Mediterranean shipping vessel. And on its maiden voyage into our port, in the channel, it passed a 6,500 TEU vessel leaving the port inside the channel. So yes, they routinely pass today. As you would suspect, you always want to improve the navigational condition. So although that's an example of two post-Panamax ships or ships that are too large to transit the Panama Canal that passed each other in the channel, the project itself will improve and enhance the conditions with which they can navigate the channel itself.
What's the mix of cargo that's moving through the port today? Is it bulk commodities, coal, grain, container freight? What do you see coming through?
Well, everything that we are predominantly talking about today are referring to our container facility. We also operate a general cargo facility in Savannah, and there are bulk handling facilities, private bulk handling facilities, both liquid and dry bulk in the port. And I think, generally speaking, all will take advantage of an improved and deepened harbor, and that's what the core studies were all about. But Savannah has become known for our container facility that, again, has been the fastest growing in the country for 10 years and is truly the gateway for all container products coming in the southeast. And it's really anything, you break it down into two directionals. But on the import side, it is predominantly consumable products or retail products. So anything, almost anything that you would find on a retailer's shelf at a Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, you name it, that product that is being produced overseas, which the vast majority of it is going to be shipped through our ports. And on the export side or the outbound side in containers, it's dominated by a couple of commodity groups, as you would suspect. In the Southeast, we produce a lot of forest products are exported, chemicals, cotton. There's an earthen material that is unique to central Georgia called kaolin and clay, and it is shipped all around the world. And we happen to be the single largest exporter in containers of containerized poultry in the United States, and we export approximately 1,200 40-foot containers of refrigerated products through our port every week, and approximately 1,000 of those are poultry. So a little bit of everything moves to our ports, and we continue to grow that cargo base every day.
Do you think the mix will change at all after the SHEP project has been completed?
No, I don't. I think there'll be more of it. There might be some subtle changes, but generally speaking, the commerce that is imported into this country, unless the overall economy changes dramatically, you're not going to see a shift in cargo. And I think on the export side, we are one of the few ports in the country that is extremely balanced, and we actually export more than we import. So for an economy that is dominated by imports, we're doing everything we can to help this economy recover, and it's driven by exports. But I don't see a significant shift in the types of goods that will be moving through our ports. And if we do, it won't be because of an expansion of our river. It will purely be driven by broader economic forces around the world.
And how do shipments move over land to and from the port? Is there on-dock rail service? Are there any plans to make any adjustments to the ground distribution system after the channel's deepened?
Well, I'd say kind of yes to all those. One of the things we're most proud of is back in about a decade before the Panama Canal was expected to be deepened. So in 2005, we embarked on a long-term planning strategy. And back in 2005, we called it our 2015 plan. And that has migrated to every 2 years, we put together a new 10-year strategic forecast. Well, the part of that original plan had several highway and rail improvements to deal with long-term growth. And when we look at our container facility, there are really three kind of macro stools that we have to improve to ensure we're dealing with capacity long-term. One of those, the three being water access, number one, two, in no particular order, two, overall port capacity or terminal capacity itself, dealing with velocity and capacity and density. And then the third part is the landside access, rail and highway. Today, approximately 20% of all of our containers moving in or out of the port move in and out via rail, so 80% are delivered via truck. We expect that split over time to increase to about 25% of our total volume moving via rail. So we are extremely fortunate to have both Class I railroads operating in the Eastern Seaboard, Norfolk Southern and CSX. They are great and outstanding partners of ours. Both have intermodal terminals on our port facility, and we've worked with both to not only expand their capacity to improve velocity, but also for each to develop a marketing network or commercial network to service the entire Southeast. So when you think of the Southeast from really Texas through Oklahoma, through the Mid-Tennessee Valley, through North Carolina, and then down through through Florida, both railroads, we've worked with them very closely to offer daily service offerings to almost every major service area within that Southeast. And so you have approximately 45% of the U.S. population resides in that Southeast territory that are described. And when you think about points like Memphis and Dallas and Houston and Birmingham and Charlotte and Atlanta and kind of on and on, all of those major markets, we're proud to say we've got services in, and we're well situated with both Class I railroads offering services to most of those points on a daily basis. So we're real proud, and we think the port is well positioned long term to service our customers from a rail standpoint. And candidly, part of that strategy was also to ensure we have outstanding highway access. And to have I-95 less than 6 miles from our port and I-16 less than 6 miles, both of those, I-95 obviously addressing the north-south corridor on the eastern seaboard, and I-16 heading through central Georgia and then into the Atlanta area, and then availability through the Mid-Tennessee Valley and Alabama and Mississippi. We're extremely well positioned, and we are working diligently with the state. And just last year, our General Assembly approved $120 million to effectively extend I-95, a direct connectivity, separated four-lane highway from I-95 directly into our port facility. So we're well positioned on the land side access point because many, many ports, unfortunately, many of our ports, if they have deep water and can access the ports, they're either restricted on the land side because of urban development around them, and then they are extremely challenged through either lack of on-dock rail or just proximity to highways. And fortunately for us, we have both available to us.
It does sound like an ideal situation. What's the estimated cost of the SHEP project?
Total project cost is $652 million. That's the Corps' estimate, and that was included in the Army Corps' record of decision. There is a cost share because it's a federal project. The state of Georgia's cost share is forecasted to be right at $262 million. and the federal share will be the balance, which is about $390 million. And that is a typical cost share. The formula gets quite complicated. It's generally a 60-40 split, and then there's a portion above a certain depth that is a higher percentage for the state. But again, so the math works out to about a 60-40 split versus a 70-30 split that's typical of a project of this magnitude.
Interesting. Does the port generate revenue that contributes to state resources?
Well, we're kind of a unique setup. First, I would tell you that when we talk about the cost share of the deepening, the $262 million is for the cost of the state of Georgia. And the reason that's the case, our structure as we've been set up, our state governance, our board, and our state leadership has asked our port to, we're responsible for both, as I mentioned earlier, managing and operating our ports, and responsible for all of the CapEx required inside of our port facilities. So we receive no funding from the state of Georgia. We're responsible for 100% of our debt and debt service, any debt that's either issued or if we are receiving bonds through the state of Georgia, we're responsible through our cash flow and through our contracts and services for fully paying that back to the state. And that's anything within our, what we refer to as our boundaries. So once you go outside of our property, whether it's highway projects or, in this case, a water highway, if you want to think of it, a federal highway being the channel, any local sponsor share or state share is going to come from the state. So we're kind of a unique structure. It's worked out exceptionally well for us. We're quite often looked at as kind of a model in the country. And again, it's very typical that states or state entities will pay for and fund kind of a deepening project, which again is a shared federal expense. But many either state authorities or local municipalities that happen to have a port authority as part of the local municipality, it's very typical that they'll receive some sort of funding from either that local municipality in the form of tax revenues or from the state. But we have been fortunate enough to structure our entire business model where we are self-sufficient and expected to be that from the state of Georgia.
Interesting organizational structure and interesting challenge. I really appreciate your spending the time with us today to help us understand the connection between what is a very large-scale infrastructure project and global competitiveness of your metropolitan area, the state of Georgia, the Southeast, and the United States. So I appreciate your insights and your conversation today. Thank you.
No problem. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers.